All right, so this is week 5 out of the 6-part series, Halacha Meets Modernity. Rabbi Ziering will wrap up the series next week, dealing with the issue of women voting, which should be fun. I noted in the email our new series is set, God willing, to begin on Monday the 27th. Our topic will be Purim and Pesach, frequently asked questions. And hopefully the flyer will be out in the next couple of days, and you'll see what we have on tap there. But tonight, the topic is, as I wrote on the sheet, the sinner. And what I want to explore are the ways in which the Enlightenment, with its impact on the Jewish world, affected the way that poskim, halachic authorities, deal with non-observance of halacha. Now, this is going to be a brief overview. We have an hour. We don't have, you know, a semester or a year to go through this properly. To really do this in depth, it would be like doctoral territory. You'd have to go through different communities and the issues they confronted and how each halachic authority dealt with the issues in his own community, compare, contrast, and so on. That's not what we're doing in the next hour. What I want to do is just take a slice of this to speak about 4 particular changes created by the Enlightenment in the way that halachic observance worked within the Jewish community, and how halachic authorities dealt with cases of transgression. So we begin by talking about the key Gemara in all of this, and it's a Gemara that distinguishes the category of mechalel Shabbos befarhesia, somebody who violates Shabbos publicly. If you take a look at source number 1, it's the Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara is part of a broader discussion. Meisve, a question is asked. We've learned. The Torah says, regarding bringing a karban chatas, a sin offering, Adam ki akriv mikem. If somebody from among you brings the karban. But the Gemara picks up on the word mikem, from among you, suggesting that not everybody can bring a karban chatas. Velo kulchem, not all of you. Who's excluded? Lahutzi as a mumar. A mumar is not able to bring a karban chatas. Mikana amru, based on this they said, mekavlin karbanos miposhe yisrael kadesha yatsru bahen bitshuva. We accept karbanos from Jews who have sinned in order to help them repent. Chutz min hamumar, except for a mumar, someone who has rebelled, umenaseich es hayayin, or someone who pours wine for avodah zara, umechal shabbosos b'fahesya, or somebody who breaks Shabbos in public. Those are the 3 who can't bring a karban chatas: the mumar, the one who pours wine for avodah zara, and the one who breaks Shabbos publicly. To which the Gemara says, I don't understand. The Haguf Akasha, this is self-contradictory. Amrit mikem velo kulchem lahutzi es hamumar. You said, one who brings a carbon among you, from among you, and you excluded the mumar. Vahadar tani, and then you said, mekavlin karbanos miposhe Yisrael. In the middle of it, you said, we do accept karbanos from sinners. So he says, halo kasha, well, that's not a problem. In other words, you see, our challenge is that the first part of the Braisa said, no, mumar cannot bring a chatas. Second part of the Braisa said, yes, a posheya, a sinner, can bring a carbon chatas. He may bring it. So the Gemara says, well, that's no problem. Obviously, mumar, who we don't accept, is different from posheya, who we do accept. Right? That's the straightforward response. How are they different? Resha mumar l'chola tarakula. The one who we exclude is somebody who says, I don't accept anything from Torah whatsoever. Mitziasa, the middle case, the one we do accept, is mumar l'davar echad. Somebody who says, I accept the Torah, there's just this one thing that I don't accept. I eat shrimp. That's the one thing I don't accept. So we exclude the one who does everything wrong. We don't exclude, we accept the one who does one thing wrong. But then they go to the end of the Braisa. Eima Seifa, the end said, Chutz min hamumar, umenase chasayayin, umachal shabbos befarhesya. There we said, we exclude 3 categories. The one who pours wine for avodah zarah, the one who violates Shabbos publicly, and a mumar. So what are you adding with the exclusion of mumar in the 3rd case? Hi mumar, hey chidami, what's the case of a mumar? E mumar l'chala tarakula, if that's to exclude the one who rejects all of Torah, wahai nereisha, you said that already in the beginning, that he's out.
When we talk about all of Torah, are we talking about written and oral?
Right now we're assuming he means everything in Torah. That's the assumption. But he says, I don't understand, you already knocked him out. V'mumar l'davar echad, and if you're talking about someone who's a mumar l'davar echad, he rejects only one aspect of Torah, kasha mitziyasa, the middle accepted him. Elalam hachi ke'amar, rather the way to read this is, chutz minamumar l'nasech es hayayinu l'chal shabasos b'farhesya. The answer is that what we exclude is the mumar to break Shabbos in public, or the mumar to pour wine for Avodah Zarah. So we're blending together the middle and the end. So the upshot of this Gemara in Source Aleph is to say that a Jew who rebels against one mitzvah in Torah is still able to bring a Karban Chatas. A Jew who dumps the whole thing cannot bring a Karban Chatas. Unless he does tshuva, that's a separate discussion. But otherwise, he can't bring this Karban. And we also drop the mumar who violates Shabbos in public or who worships Avodah Zarah. Rashi there explains this, why it is that we pick out Shabbos like this. He says, I brought it for you in source number one. He says, Haytana, the end of that line, in the end of the first line in Rashi. Haytana chamira le Shabbos ka Avodah Zarah. According to the Tana of this braisa, Shabbos is as strict as Avodah Zarah. De ha'ovid Avodah Zarah kofer b'kadosh baruch hu. Because if one worships idols, it's like he denies God. Not like he denies God. He denies God. That's the definition. V'machal Shabbos, and somebody who breaks Shabbos, kofer b'ma'asav. He denies the deeds of God. Umeid sheker, and he testifies falsely. Shlosh Shabbos HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'ma'aseh bereishis. He denies that Hashem rested, that Hashem halted in the act of creation. So the Gemara here says that one who violates Shabbos publicly is as though he had worshipped idols, and this is brought as halacha by the Rambam and Hilchos Shabbos Perek Lamed, and I think it's relatively well known. We don't appear to distinguish between reasons why he breaks Shabbos. Meaning, when it comes to other Averos, the Gemara in Harios Daf Yud Aleph, I didn't bring it on the sheet, distinguishes between somebody who violates an Avera l'tei avon, because he really wants something, and someone who violates an Avera l'hachis, because he wants to get God angry. He says, I'm going to show you, right? Paradoxically, the greatest ma'amin there is, right? The greatest believer there is the mumar l'hachis. He believes there's God, and he wants to make him angry. There's something there, but in any case, when it comes to other violations, we distinguish between one intent and another. When it comes to Mechal Shabbos b'farhesya, someone who breaks Shabbos publicly, we don't appear to distinguish. I don't care why he does it. I don't care if he does it because he has a job and he wants parnasa, or if he does it because he wants to show God or he wants to show the community. It doesn't make a difference. In all these cases, we reject him from bringing a korban. In this case, being able to shecht and so on. Two applications of this law, which we're going to see play out in our sources. One is the issue of wine. We know that if a non-Jew touches wine which is not mevushel, that wine is no longer usable for us. Right? In the Deoraisa level, it was a concern for Yayin Nesach, wine being dedicated for Avodah Zarah. But even if it's not dedicated for Avodah Zarah, he's not an idolater, he doesn't believe in Avodah Zarah, it doesn't make a difference. We have an Issur Derabanan Mishum Chasnus. You have a rabbinic prohibition, lest you end up marrying him. It will lead to socialization. You will realize that he's not such a bad guy after all, and that can lead to potential intermarriage. If I were to ask you based on that, should there be a rabbinic prohibition when you're dealing with somebody who is Jewish but not observant, what would you say? Right, I would say, why in the world should that apply? There's no Isser Chasnus, you're allowed to marry them. Yeah, it may not go well if you are coming from one religious point of view and they're coming from another religious point of view, but that's what you work out when you're dating. Right? What's the issue here? Why is this a problem? Take a look, please, at source number two. The Beis Yosef quoting Rabbeinu Yonah. He says, Od mi pi Rabbeinu Yonah shesham mechachmei Tzorfas, from the sages of France. Mishumad lechalol Shabbosas b'farhesya, somebody who violates Shabbos publicly. O she'enu mamin b'divar Rabboseinu Zal, or he doesn't believe in the words of the rabbis. Who min, he's called a min, that's his category. V'yeino yayin nesach, and his wine is treated as yayin nesach. The Inyan Chilul Shabbos Vavaras Diber Rabosenu Zala Dato Sha'Oved Avodah Zarah Hu Davka Shaya Muchzak Bo Shalosh Pa'amim. He says that specifically if the guy does this three times. Avol Pam Achas, the fact that he broke Shabbos once in public, or Shdayim, or even twice, Eino Oseyaya Nesach, that doesn't do it. Ubifnei Asara Tzara Sheikhalal, and it has to be in front of tents. The Beis Yosef says this quoting Rabbeinu Yonah, elsewhere he says it quoting the Rashba. The Binyan Sion, we'll see below, is going to answer our question of, but he's Jewish. So we'll come back to that. But that's the statement that the Beis Yosef makes, and that is brought as halacha by many halachic authorities, that if someone breaks Shabbos publicly as a pattern of behavior, then his wine, if it's not mevushal, is going to be non-kosher. Now there's a whole other realm of discussion which we're not going to get into, which is, what if he only violates derabbanans? And you need witnesses that he violated? How does that actually work? Do they have to testify in Beis Din? That's a whole other discussion, but this isn't the topic of our shiur. If our shiur were about the status of wine for, touched by a mumar, then we would have to have this discussion. Jeffrey Silver emailed me a link to a tradition article by Rabbi J. David Bleich where he discusses this at length. He has the very interesting question, if you have a Jew who violates Shabbos publicly, is he allowed to drink his own wine? His own non-mevushal wine? Right, that would be part of the question. So Ayin Shum, I think I actually referenced it somewhere in my notes. If I find it in my notes, I'll tell you what issue it was in tradition. But yeah, it's one of the last 5 years or so. Okay. In any case, that's one application of this category of Mechal Shabbos Bifarhes. Yeah, the other one is the question of including him in a minyan. If you take a look at the line from the Shulchan Aruch in source number 3, the Shulchan Aruch writes, Avaryan Sha'avar Gzeiras Tzibur, a sinner who violates the communal decree, O Sha'avar Avera, or he transgresses, Im Lo Niduhu Nimna L'Minyan Asara, as long as he's not in Cherem, as long as he's not excommunicated, he counts towards the Minyan. Okay. On that, the Prima Gadim in source number 4 says, Mumar la avoda zara v'chilo Shabbos. If a person is a mumar for idolatry or for breaking Shabbos, o lahachis bedavar echad, or he violates even one mitzvah, but he does it to anger God, hareyu ke'akum. He has the status of an idolater, ve'ein mitzareif. He won't count for a minyan. So writes the Prima Gadim in 18th century Poland. There's also a separate discussion about the nature of his brachos in answering Amen, and that's its own discussion. So this introduces us to the fact that we have a halachic concept of somebody who violates Shabbos publicly, and we are told that his wine is not kosher, and we are told that, according to the Prima Gadim, he won't qualify for a minyan. Now we have to shift gears and talk a little bit of history, and specifically the impact of the Enlightenment on the Jewish world. And I'm going to be brief in describing the history rather than make this into a discussion, because there's so much for us to talk about here. But basically what you see in the Enlightenment, 17th century into the 18th century, throughout the 18th century, is a growth of trust in the advances of science, as there are new discoveries which make predictions that bear out, and which explain things that people had wondered about for a very long time. There's a growth of trust in the advances of science. There is, along with that, a growth of lack of trust for tradition, because scientists propose theories that contradict religious ideas, right? The idea that the earth is the center and everything goes around the earth being one favorite. With the growth of scientific ideas comes a weakening of tradition. There is also a rejection of the status quo, the idea that my position in this world is dictated by some greater force, God or otherwise, such that the country I am from, the socioeconomic class that I am born into, my race, my gender, whatever it is going to frame my, who I am for life. That is challenged during the Enlightenment and then forever forward from there. That form of Enlightenment itself died. With the barbarism associated with the end of the French Revolution, the people became disillusioned with the idea that science is our savior from everything. Nonetheless, it continues to be a driving force in different ways down till today. It suffered another blow with the Holocaust, and people looked at what that great civilization in Germany had produced. So, over time, there have been sort of waves of pro-Enlightenment, pro-science, and then reaction to it. But the result of this, in general, has been four levels of impact on the Jewish world in terms of mitzvah observance. Direct impact number one was that it liberated Jews from the ghetto to merge with society. And that starts primarily with Napoleon. As he conquers areas, he liberates the Jews. He says, if you will agree to be fine, upstanding members of society and loyal to my empire, then I will liberate you. And even though Napoleon is defeated, when he is defeated, those nations who take over from him, over time, liberate the Jews from the ghetto. Direct impact number two, going along with that, is that Jews are enabled to attend university. Po v'sham, here and there, you had university attendance beforehand, but systematically, in terms of Jews in general being admitted, with a quota perhaps, you find more Jews attending university with the Age of Enlightenment going forward. Third, you find a rejection of Mesorah just because it is Mesorah. Meaning the idea that this is what my tradition has said all along, therefore it must be correct, is an idea that is rejected by many at that stage. And then fourth, you find the application of critical techniques to study of Torah. So people, this is later Enlightenment, but people start to look at the Torah as just another text written by human beings over time, subject to analysis, and not something that is sacred. That in turn leads to four changes in the Jewish community to which halachic authorities need to respond. Number one, a weakening of Jewish education. With a lack of pressure of being in the ghetto with everybody else and doing what everybody else is doing, with the influence of new neighbors and co-workers and students in the university, Jews spread and they move out, especially to the new world. There's a lot of skepticism about the value of Torah. So what you find is a weakening of Jewish education for youth. Number two, you find a change in attitudes. You find a growth of cynicism / agnosticism about religion and God. Logical enough from these forces. Third, you find a de-emphasis of practical observance. You find other ways that people identify as Jewish, but they're not necessarily going to observe halacha. And then fourth, you find a shrinking of and weakening of the community of those who are observant. So on a communal level, as opposed to the individual level, you find a weakening of the community. And again, really, that deserves its own shiur to talk about how that played out in different places, bring you some sources on it. But those are the four principles that I'm sort of taking as given here. These four phenomena. And now what we need to spend the next 45 minutes on is how halachic authorities responded to each of the four. Are we clear? We've identified the existing category of Mechal al Shabbos Bifur Hestia and some of the costs associated with being identified that way. And we have seen that in this era there are four major changes: education, attitudes to God, attitudes to religious practice, and the nature of the community. And the question is going to be, do the terms you used until then, Mechal al Shabbos Bifur Hestia, in our specific case, do they make sense when you're dealing with a post-Enlightenment world, or do you have to acknowledge and take into consideration certain changes? So, first of all, the weakening of Jewish education. So the weakening of Jewish education leads to two arguments for leniency in the way that you approach people who sin. The first argument is a well-known one, although it's worth seeing it and walking through it. And that is the argument that the person who breaks Shabbos is not really mezid, right? Mezid means what? Intentional, right? And mezid means somebody violates intentionally. And here we say, you know what? Not everybody who breaks Shabbos is actually doing so intentionally. Not in the sense that, oops, by accident I turned on a light, but in the sense that he doesn't really know what he's doing because he doesn't understand the import of what he's doing. Whereas 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 500 years ago, everybody knew this is a no-no and it was a norm that you don't do this. Today it's not necessarily true. That's the argument that is brought. Whether that's true historically is another question. But that's one of the arguments that's brought, and it's brought in a couple of different ways. One is the concept of the Omer Mutter, and the other one is the concept of Tinok Shenishba. What is an Omer Mutter? What does that mean? Someone who says it's permissible. What does that mean? He thinks that it's allowed. Why in the age of the Enlightenment would people suddenly think something like breaking Shabbos was allowed? Not thinking that it's okay, but thinking that it's actually allowed by halacha? What would cause that change? Oh, no, we're not at the stage of new technologies yet.
Rational thinking. Rationalization,
maybe.
Lack of education.
Lack of education will be part of it. Denominization, or denominalization, I'm not sure how to turn that word. The growth of denominations. Meaning, my friend down the block has a rabbi, and he says this is okay. Right? Before I came to Toronto, I was in Allentown, Pennsylvania. So one of Allentown's claims to fame is that Rav Kook sent a tshuva to Allentown, Pennsylvania. Rabbi Shlomo Krebsky was a rav in Manchuria during the Communist Revolution. And at that point, all of his balabatim who were living there were businessmen who were from Russia. They all went home to take care of their families. His shul disappeared. So he left. And was met by Reb Lazer Silver when he got on a transport. He ended up in Seattle. Reb Lazer Silver, who was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I believe at the time, went to Seattle, met him, and said the community of Allentown needs a chief rabbi. And he brought him to Allentown. So he shows up in Allentown and he finds that there's somebody there who's a shochet ubodek. His job is to oversee kosher meat, and he also. When there's a funeral on the second day of Yom Tov, which you know from the Gemara Beitza you're allowed to do, but when there's a funeral on the second day of Yom Tov, he rides in a car to the cemetery, the Shochet Ubodik. And Reb Krebsky tries to tell people, you're not allowed to do that. This the funeral, Mela, but you can't ride in a car. And the Shochet Ubodik says, sure you can. So he sends away to Rav Kook. I don't know why specifically Rav Kook, but he sends a letter away to Rav Kook to get an answer. And Rav Kook, it's in Arachmish, but you can find it, sends a tshuva back saying, no, absolutely not. And his meat is treif and so on. You can't do that. But that's exactly what we're talking about. Because if you're Stambala Bas, and the Shochet Ubodek, whose meat you've been eating for years, tells you this is okay. You think it's okay. That's what Omer Mutter means. You think that the rabbi said that this is all right. Take a look, please, at source number 5. Gemara in Shabbos. Omer Mar, they're quoting the mission, the first mission in Parakla Gadol. Chomer Shabbos Mishar Mitzvos. Shabbos is stricter than other mitzvos. Shabbos asa shtayim behelem echot chayav al kolachas viachas. Mashenkin bishar mitzvos. On Shabbos, if you perform two different prohibitions, or it sounds like two different prohibitions, in one span of forgetting that this is wrong, you're liable for each one, as opposed to other mitzvos. And the Gemara wants to know, what exactly are you talking about? What does that mean you did two different prohibitions? Hey Chidami, what's your case? He did two different malachos. Okay? He did two different malachos. He harvested and he ground up the grain. And what do you mean when you say that for Shabbos you're liable twice? But if you did this with other mitzvahs, you wouldn't be? Avodah Zarah. That's talking about if you did two different acts with Avodah Zarah. If you slaughtered for Avodah Zarah and you burned something on a mizbeach for Avodah Zarah, you'd only be liable once. So the Gemara says, wait a minute. The Mayo Kimta, the second paragraph in source number 5. What's your case? Ba'avodah Zarah, you're talking idolatry. Ema Seifa, look at the end of that Mishnah, which said, Chomer b'sha'ar mitzvos, she'b'sha'ar mitzvos, shogar b'lo miskaven chayiv, ma'she'in kein b'shabes. You can't be talking about Avodah Zarah, because you also said under this banner of other mitzvos, which you're saying is idolatry, that in the event that someone did it b'shogeg, by accident, he's liable. So he says, wait a minute. Hai shagak b'lo miskaven d'avodah zarah, hechidami. How do you do avodah zarah by accident? What does that mean? Ilem a kasavur beis hakneses hu bishtachav elav. You can tell me, he went up to the temple of the Greek god, whatever, and he bowed to it thinking that it was a shul. That's not avodah zarah. Libo l'shamayim. His heart is for shamayim. Ve'el d'chazi andarta v'sagilah. So maybe it's that he saw the statue of the king, and he bowed to that. How does that work? Dot, dot, dot. Conclusion, be'omer mutter. It's talking about somebody who says it is entirely permitted. If a person worships Avodah Zarah thinking that that's allowed, that the Torah says you're allowed to do that, He is going to be he's going to be liable for avodah zarah. Mashenkin b'Shabbos, as opposed to Shabbos, where we say he is nepatur legamri. He's exempt entirely. How in the world did you come up with a case of Omer Mutter for Shabbos? The Rashi gives you two cases. In source number 5 still. Kigon Gershinis Gayer Bein Anachrim. You have a guy who wasn't Jewish, who converted with a proper Beis Din, but he lived among non-Jews, and he was never trained. He went to the Beis Din, and he said, I want to be a Jew. And they said, okay, Bris Milah, Mikvah, presto, you're a Jew. He doesn't know anything. Lives among non-Jews, doesn't know anything about Shabbos. He thinks there's no, or in this case, Avodah Zarah. That's a case that Rashi brings. So Omer Mutter is one category that becomes very relevant. People who think something is permitted, didn't know any better. The other related category is Tinok Shenishba, the child who was captured and raised by non-Jews. And I'm not going to read it inside just in the interest of time, but I brought it for you in source number 6, also from that same discussion in the Gemara in Shabbos, the concept of a Tinok Shenishba. He was taken captive and raised without knowledge of Shabbos. The Rambam brings this idea when it deals with Karaites and Tzedukim. The Rambam has a fascinating chronology for the development of the Tzedukim and the Karaim, the Sadducees and the Karaites. And to make a long story short, I brought it for you in source number 7, but he has this notion that that initially you had Tzadok and Baitos, the Sadducees and the Bothusians, who had one type of a heresy, and then their children followed them afterwards, and he describes the children of Tinok as Tinok Shenishba. They don't know any better. They were raised by people who didn't educate them properly. So you can see exactly where this is going. The first major halachic authority to bring this argument post-Enlightenment in order to change our view of somebody who violates halacha is Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, the Binyan Tzion. In source number 8, it's in his Tshuvos HaChadashos number 23. He was asked the question of wine touched by somebody who is a Mechalal Shabbos Befarhesia. Now, just to know who he was a little bit, he was the leader of early German Orthodoxy. He was the Rebbe of Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. He was the Rebbe of Rav Israel Hildesheimer. He's a very, very significant halachic name. He brings first reasons to prohibit the wine, and then he adds reasons for leniency. First he goes through the prohibitions and he spells them out, but then he says there are three reasons to be lenient. If you take a look at source number 8, after presenting the question in the opening line, he says, Lafiani is daiti, in my humble opinion, hadin imo. He says, you are right, to the person who is who asked him the question. Dekevin de machal shabbos befarhesia hu kumumer lachalatara dino kove kochavim. He says, the person who violates Shabbos publicly, he's a mumer for the entire Torah, and he is the status of an idolater. Ve'ein lomar, and don't say, Moish, this goes back to your question. He says, ve'ein lomar, kevin dekzeres yenem hu mishum b'noseim. If the whole reason to prohibit the wine is because of intermarriage, all right, b'nos machal shabbos lo nesru, their daughters are mutter, they're Jewish. Zeino, he says, no. Deim kin mumar lavodas kochavim lo yes or yayin bishasiya. He says, it's not true, because then you would tell me that a Jew who worshipped idols also, the wine would be permitted. Not true. The Gemara in Chulin explicitly says, asur. Vitzarech lomar, flip the page, k'moshekasav haran yatsay, as the Ran says, that once the Chachamim gave this person the status of an idol worshipper, all the laws of idol worshippers apply to them. Even ones that logically don't make sense, like the intermarriage one, will still apply. But then he says the following on the third line on the page. Vihine, ad ko dibarnu me ikar hadin, eich lidon machal shabbos bifarhesia. Until now, we've spoken of the basic law for someone who violates Shabbos publicly. Avoleposhe yisrael shebizmanenu lo yedana me'edon bohem. But he says, for people who sin today, I don't know how to judge them. Achar sheba avonusenu harabim pastaha baheres larov ad sheruvam chilo shabbos nasek aheter. He says sin has spread so widely that they think it's actually allowed. They think that the people who are careful about Shabbos are just crazy machmirim. That's the way they look at it. and maybe they have the law of Omer Mutter. And he says, I'll tell you something. Yesh b'hem shemispalim tefillah Shabbos u'mekadshim kiddush hayom. They daven. Right? That's not a novel idea. They daven, they make kiddush, right? You know the articles, right? Blech makes reference to it in his piece, but I've seen this elsewhere as well. That the origin of a shul hashkama minyan, right? What's the origin of the hashkama minyan? People who had to go to work. They wanted to daven and then go off to work. So you had hashkama minyan on Shabbos, and then they would go off to work, but they would daven. So he says, they're davening, they're making kiddush. You can't tell me they deny, that Hashem created the world. And then in the next paragraph, the next part that I bolded, umad gam bivnehem asher kamu tachten asher lo yadu velo shamu dine Shabbos, and their kids don't know any different. So the parent has the status of the omer mutter, thinks it's okay, and the child has the status of a tinok shenishba. He was taken captive. You can't blame him. It's like the Rambam's description of the kids of the Tzdukim. And therefore his conclusion is, if you jump to the end of number 8, Lefi Anius Daiti Hamachmir Lachshiv Nigias Yain Shalaposham Halal Stamiyam Tavual of Bracha Achen Gamla Makilam Yeshama Mashi Yismauchu. He says, yeah, if you're strict with it, that's good. Don't drink the wine. But frankly, he says, if you're lenient, you have basis for being lenient, unless you know for sure this is a real Mechalal Shabbos, not one of these watered-down Mechalal Shabbos that we have. So the Binyan Sion's position is, post-enlightenment, weakening of education, popularization of sin, I think that you can call them an Omer Mutter, and you can call their kids a Tinok Shenishba. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, brought this in even stronger terms in source number 9. He says, Mumeris sheyesh la ben min hanach risha ben mumer kamoha. If you have a woman who has a child with a non-Jew, and the kid, he's Jewish, he's a mumer like her. So he says, you're not allowed to lend him money and charge interest and to say, well, he's like a non-Jew, because he's a mumer for Shabbos and all that. You can't say that. Because he is like a tinok shenishba. And then this is a strong part. He says, even if he later hears that he's Jewish, and he sees Jews and he sees what they do, nonetheless, in other words, the fact that he's exposed to Judaism doesn't change the status of a tinok shenishba. He's viewed as having been forced into this. Because he was raised with the laws of the non-Jews. That's his position. Interestingly, the Menchas Elazar notes something funny. Reb Chaim Elazar Shapira, the Menchas Elazar, did not like this idea one bit. If you know the Menchas Elazar a little bit, you will not be surprised. He does not like this idea one bit. And he points out something interesting. If you look at the Binyan Sion's Tshuva in the original, not the Hebrew books, electronic version of it, but if you look at an actual Sefer, you see that below the heading where it says Simen Chav Gimel, on the next line it says Psakim Shalola Halacha LaMaaseh, rulings which are not meant for practical implementation. So he liked that idea. Number 10, the Menchas Elazar says, "V'yafa asu amotze la'ur b'Binyan Zion." He says the publishers of the Binyan Zion did the right thing. The shemidu atshuva ahi b'simen chav gimel asher nitpas mikodem l'simen ahi shemayaz v'hala nitpasu psakim shlolach l'mais. He says that's actually a heading for that section, which is not so clear when you actually look in the Sefer. It looks like it's really just on this tshuva. But he does note that, and it's worth noting. Nonetheless, disclaimer or not, this gets quoted lahalacha, generally speaking, with the Tinok Shenishba banner.
What's happening with Menchas Elazar?
He doesn't like the idea.
So he's saying that the thing that...
And he said the Binyan Zion never intended this as a practical tshuva, or the publisher thought it shouldn't be a practical tshuva. We learn halachas from publishers all the time. We could do a series on halachas that have been created by publishers. We probably should at some point.
Is he really saying the publishers are the ones we're following here and not the band?
Well, the question is, he's assuming the publisher actually knew what he was doing. That's the assumption that he's making. We'll get back to his objection in a minute. The Binyan Zion is brought la halacha. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman in his Malamed Lahoil was asked about counting a Mechalal Shabbos in the Minyan. And in source number 11, he brings this point. He has a great story. He says in number 11, he says, Bismanazen, the middle of the top line, Bismanazen, Noagin Lahakil, today they are lenient, Af be'eretz Ungarin, even among the Hungarians, umikol shekein be'eretz Ashkenaz, and certainly in Germany, uzchurani, where he is, uzchurani shepam achas ira avelus liish echad shchanusa pasuach b'Shabbos. Once there was a guy who was in avelus, his store was open on Shabbos, v'hu ech mibalei batim shekila senu kaladas Yisrael. He was a member of our shul. V'yara lefnei ateva v'beis haknesset shekila senu. He was the chazan. Achagaba yada l'ratzos osu l'faiso shlo yerid omen b'shar kol yiranenu al zeh. The Gabbai knew how to talk to him to convince him not to do this again. People won't like it. They'll say nasty things. Fine. What happened? Achagah halach zeh ish l'beis haknesset shel chaver shas. So he went down the block to some other shul. V'avsha Gabbai d'sham haya ish chared v'yirei elokim. The Gabbai there was a God-fearing man. Nonetheless, he nichu l'eri l'fnei ateva b'limaniya. He said, sure, you can go daven. Kasher sha'aldi es ha-gabai lama lama na'ahu. I asked the gabai, why didn't you stop him? Amar lish, kenu gam ken minog miyamim kadmonim beis ha-medrash depo. He says, that's a little old practice. Sha'in monim yilei lefnei ha-teva anoshim shem eskaram pasuch b'Shabbos. We don't stop people whose businesses are open on Shabbos from davening for the yamud. They came into our banim nisham shayu anshei shem lo michu mistama yatama v'nimokam imam. So he says, they knew what they're doing. And then he quotes you the Binyan Tziyah as his basic basis for it. The Beis Yitzchak Evan Ezer Beis Samachay does this in the case of Igun. The Shubas van Hagos through Sternbach discusses this in the case of giving somebody an Aliyah, and quotes the Tinok Shanishba idea as well in source number 12. So there are those. Ramosha Feinstein quoted it as well. Ramosha, I didn't bring it on here. It's a truth we're going to come back to later. Talks about someone who makes a living as a chazan in a synagogue where they use a microphone on Shabbos. And he says, the guy's an Omer Mutter. He thinks there are rabbis who say he can't use a microphone, and there are rabbis who say you can use a microphone. So he thinks it's Mutter, according to at least some, and that's his justification for what he's doing. Now, the Menachas Elazar, as I mentioned, was not happy with this idea. Take a look at number 13, and you see what he's upset about. He says, "V'gam lo dami l'gamri akofrim b'avodaseinu rabim b'yameinu gam b'medinos Ashkenaz l'akaroyim shishkashonim b'medinos she'ein sham Yisrael." He says, "Don't bring me proofs from the Rambam about Karaites and Tzedukim and the descendants of the Tzedukim." He says, "The sinners who live among us, meaning Hungary, right, or even in Germany, they're not like the Karaites. Why? The Karaites didn't know any Jews. They lived off on their own. They were their own nation. So they couldn't know what the practices of Israel are. They live far from Israel. This is where I have Bleich's articles in my notes. It's Tradition, Volume 44, Number 3, page 82. On that point, he disagrees historically. He says that's not true. The Karaites lived among Jews. They had plenty of exposure to Jews. So he disagrees from a factual point of view. But the Menachas Elazar says, if they get to know Jews, you can't call them Tinok Shanishba. The Menachas Yitzchak, with Yitzchak Weiss in England, did not like it either. He said this argument is a Dochak Gadol. And the Oz Nidbaru did not like it for sure in source number 15. The Oz Nidbaru is a Talmud, Rabbi Yamin Zilber is a Talmud of the Chazon Ish. And he says, it's one thing to say, as the Rav Chaim Ozer did in a tshuva to Jews living in South Africa, to say, well, they don't know any better. He says, we're living in Israel. These people see Jews all the time observing mitzvahs. You can't make that argument. He says, Kiruv is all well and good, but you can't tell me that this person is a Tinok Shanishba. So this is one of the arguments that's brought with the change in education, is to say they don't know any better, so don't judge them as Mechal HaShabbos b'Farhesia. The other argument that goes along with this change in education is the argument that Rav Sternbach makes in source number 16, and that is Kiruv is possible. Because they don't know any better, if they were just exposed to learning, they would do differently. And so I brought you this piece from Sternbach where he says, you know, we are able to do that. We're able to bring them back, and therefore our practice is to be lenient so that we don't scare them off.
I don't understand what the Zilber's intention. In fact, I never do about the Zilber's at all. In Poland, the Mount Jubilee were around Germany, not in every place, but in many places. In a month.
Right, but his argument is that Shuba's written in Germany, where you actually have a much stronger non-observant population, and you can live among them and not see observant Jews.
I'm
Even in Germany, there are differences of communities. There's Berlin, Frankfurt.
Right, but in those communities, there were also healthy representation, not markedly dissimilar to the proportion of observance in that as well. But again, let's say one in, you know, the time he wrote this is probably less than 20% of the Indians as well.
This I don't know.
Because I don't understand how any of the argument based on location as opposed to the normal budget.
I understand what you're saying. That's his position. But that's all under the banner of education. The argument of either Omer Mutter, Tinok Shenishba, or Kiruv is possible. I want to shift us into the second phenomenon. Meaning that these are people who, because their non-observance is a function of ignorance, if you could only create a relationship and expose them to Torah, then they would actually be open to it and they would change. That's the argument. If you take a look at number 16, I'm rushing a little bit, so I didn't read it inside, but take a look towards the end of it. He says, towards the end of the third line, after he quotes you the Rambam in Igeres HaShmad, he writes, Kol shkein bizmanenu, shebe'etzem ro'im, shema'asu b'chayim, shigiyu l'diyota tachtonu matchilim lalos. He says, these are people who aren't happy with the way things are. They've reached the bottom and now they're starting to climb up. He says, draw them near and then they will come close to mitzvos as well. And therefore we are lenient in various things with them. They're open to coming back, he writes. Now, phenomenon number two, we said, was the growth of cynicism and agnosticism. And this goes the exact opposite direction. It leads not to leniency, but to stringency. For two reasons. One reason is, today's sinner is worse because they go further than just one Avera. Take a look at the Nitziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who people often think of as a very open-minded, you know, easygoing, stop thinking that way. Number 17, look at this tshuva. Al devar lehitzaref im hamechunim b'shem Beis Yaakov. Regarding joining with those who are known as Beis Yaakov, he does not mean the Beis Yaakov schools. What I think he's talking about is the Bilu, the Chovei Tzion, Beit Yaakov lechuven elcha. Even though the Nitziv was known for not being hard against the Chovei Tzion. Nonetheless, I believe that's what he's referring to here. I actually found, I was looking around online to see if anybody would identify this group, and I found a paper by Gil Pearl called No Two Minds Are Alike, Tolerance and Pluralism in the Work of Nitziv, and I found in footnote 13, he raises the same doubt that I did, of maybe this is the Bilu. But take a look at what he says. He says, they violate Shabbos publicly. He says, you may not join with them in anything relating to service of God. He's talking davening specifically here. Yeah, as you'll see. And even though, he says, the Shulchan Aruch says the Avarian, we saw this before, counts. That's if he's a mumer for one thing. Even though the pasuk says that the offering of the wicked is repellent, we also saw the Gemara in Chulin that says you accept the carbon from a mumer. At the end of the third line in this source, certainly the tefillah hakala. If you're just dealing with tefillah, it's not like a carbon with all the rules of carbonos. He says, not an idolater, not somebody who breaks Shabbos publicly. We wouldn't accept a carbon from him. We wouldn't accept tefillah from him. How in the world can you join with him for davening? Absolutely not. He says, these people are too far off. They're just the opposite, not Omer Mutter Tinok Shenishba. These are people who have rejected everything. The Levushe Mordechai took the same position, Rav Mordechai Yehuda Leib Winkler, writing in Hungary in 1913, quoting the Chasam Sofer. He talks about, if you see the words I bolded, somebody who was involved, Be'esek Tadir Shel Masa Umatan, somebody who was constantly involved, regularly involved, I should say, in business on Shabbos. So he argues for Chumrah for that reason. These people have rejected everything. The second argument for stringency that's brought also by Rabbi Mordechai Leib Yehuda Leib Winkler, is that these people have no emunah. It's not just that they're committing multiple sins. They don't believe, and they just pick and choose what they want to observe. in source number 19. He quotes you a sefer called Pri Tawar on the Shulchan Aruch, who says, Mishen Mekayim Takanos Ugzeros Chazal, somebody who doesn't fulfill the decrees of the Chachamim, Klomar Derech HaBikorsus, meaning in the manner of heresy, Uborer Derech La'atzma, he chooses his own way, Takana Zu Nira Be'enav, this Takana he likes, Takana Acheres Tachenav Meraos, the other one, he blocks his eyes from seeing, Ein Mitztarfen Osa L'chol Darash HaBekdusha, you can't bring him into a... you can't count him for a minion. So the first argument is they violate all things in practice. The second argument is that they have no faith. So so this is the exact opposite. Lack of education leads to leniency. Growth of cynicism and rejection of belief and violation of many halachos leads the opposite direction. Leads to stringency. Clear?
Yeah.
No, Lubavitcher Mordechai will not count them. He will not have you join a minion, and that's also what the Nitziv seems to say. The Nitziv gets even stronger in the next paragraph. I didn't bring you his full tshuva. I didn't bring it on the other side either. No, but no, they don't want you to count them in a minion. Now, the third phenomenon, the de-emphasis of practical observance. So that actually leads to a popular argument for leniency, which I think should be revisited nowadays. The argument goes, people don't take practical observance all that seriously. They just don't look at it as being that serious. And therefore, they sin l'tayavon. They want to make a living, so they'll open their store, because that's not really the essence of being Jewish anyway, whether I keep Shabbos or not. I feel Jewish. I identify as a Jew. I give to the tzedakah, whatever it is. Practical observance I'm not so good at. That's my weak point. And the argument goes, they sin l'tayavon. We already saw this argument before. The Binyan Siyam said that. He said they believe, they make kiddush, they daven. They're just not so great in terms of, you know, all the different halachos. And no less than Rav Yaakov Emden makes this point as well. If you take a look at source number 20, Rav Yaakov Emden writes, Ubifrat ha'idna, he says, especially nowadays, da'afilu goyim shebechutz laretz lav ovdei avodah zarah ninu elamina gavoseim bideim, he says, the non-Jews aren't from either. They're not worshipping avodah zarah because they believe in it. Dad did it, so I do it too. Kol shekein Yisrael shehemir, certainly the Jew who has left the path, she'eino b'chezkas min gamur ad sheyuchzak la'aduk ba'avodah zarah. We wouldn't view him as a full-blown min, such that we would say, yeah, he's an idolater now. He says, it's not true. The reason why he did it is because he has tasted prohibitions and he likes the way they taste. He says they do it to satisfy their yetzer for sin. They do it out of a desire for money. That's why they're doing it. It's not that they are so bad. And he even says, I think I brought it on here. The piece from the Shoal Umeshiv, is that in this one? I don't see it now. I had a piece from the Shoal Umeshiv that I thought was here, but it's in a different one. But in any case, you see what he's saying. You know what? It's not the Shoal Umeshiv, but what I wanted you to see is one line up from the bottom in the middle of this, in the middle of line, Shmamina. He says, Shmamina diyadus tkua belibo ve'eino ose ela lepanim. Judaism is embedded in his heart. What he's doing, his avera is superficial. That's not who he is. He hasn't rejected belief in Judaism. That's the position of Rav Yaakov Emden. There are others along the same lines. Rav Moshe has a particularly interesting insight in this regard, which he quotes in a bunch of tshuvos. Rav Moshe had a remarkable take, which I brought you in number 21. He says, why do we emphasize this business of breaking Shabbos b'farhesya? I'm going to explain it outside because it takes a while to walk through it inside. Why do we make such a big deal about someone breaking Shabbos publicly? If breaking Shabbos is terrible, then several, whether it's private or public. And if what you care about is the public aspect of things, then it's any avera that you do in public, not specifically Shabbos. And don't tell me, he says, maybe it's a combination. Because it's Shabbos and because it's public, that's what makes it, he doesn't like that idea. Rather, what he says is this. When a person breaks Shabbos, it could be it's because they really don't believe. they've rejected belief, or it could be that they break Shabbos because they want to make a living, because they're hungry for something, they want to go somewhere, whatever it is. And you don't really know what their rationale is. If someone does this in public, then they understand that there are going to be people who are watching them who don't know them and don't know what they're thinking and who think they're doing it as a rejection of Shabbos, Bereishis, Torah. So by doing, by breaking Shabbos in public, that's the message they are broadcasting. With other averos, it's not so, Rav Moshe says. Because other averos don't involve an inherent rejection of creation. It's Shabbos specifically that testifies to creation. And if they do it in private, it's also not a declaration to the world, because the assumption is if anybody does see, remember, public means 10. So if there's two or three people around, yeah, they know me well enough to know I don't, I'm not like that. It's specifically Mechalel Shabbos Bifarhesia that demonstrates it. So Rav Moshe says, if I have a Jew who we know that he davens, we know that he makes Kiddush, we know that in general he observes mitzvos, then he's not going to be assumed to be a mechalel. We're not going to treat him as though he doesn't believe, as though he's a kofer and all that. It's not so. You follow Rav Moshe's logic? That's the argument that he brings. I wrote it on the sheet. You can see the bold part in particular in number 21. He says kishemachal b'farhesia re'baharbe rowin yiyu misha yomer shahu mitzad shakofer b'maseh bereishis. That's what people are going to think when they see him do so. But if we know that it's not so, if we know it's not true, if you jump to the one line up from the bottom, umemela mashe yodeya ba'atzmo she'eino kofir, when we know about this person that he's not a denier, v'os is erak l'tav osav, he's doing it because he has this great desire, shelo yachol lichbo shes yitzro, he can't control himself, then that's a different story. Actually, that line is in the middle of the discussion about Mechalel Shabbos before Hesi. I shouldn't mix the two. But that's your Moshe's argument, is that if we know that he's not really a kofer, he doesn't really deny it, then we don't have to worry about this. Now, there are two challenges to this argument. Challenge number one is brought by the Minchas Elazar in source number 22. He says, "Kishemechalo b'malacha b'mezi b'farhesi." A person violates Shabbos knowingly in public. He's denying that God halted on Shabbos. Sheshvishas Hakadosh Baruch Hu ve'yakol ha'layla v'chol hayom yom hashvi'i. He says God didn't observe Shabbos, so to speak, for part of the day. He stopped doing malacha in the beginning of Shabbos, and he didn't do malacha throughout Shabbos. Uma ahani b'kiddush sha'oza. Who cares that he made kiddush? V'chi yesh shvisa l'chatzi Shabbos? Is there such a thing as keeping half Shabbos? Right? He was very prescient in that regard. He knew the half Shabbos term. He says, there's nothing as keeping half Shabbos. Yishtaku advarm lai omru l'hakel ayadei zebiyei. No, he says, God forbid. You absolutely cannot pay any attention to this.
Yeah. The possibility that he didn't think it all the way through. He just was Mechalel Shabbos.
Well, except that the person does it week after week after week.
Yeah, but you're not necessarily thinking through the implication of what you're...
Right.
That's what
Rav Moshe is. Right, that's what Rav Moshe's argument. And Michal Zalaj's point is well taken in the sense that a person is Mechalel Shabbos without necessarily spending all 25 hours, riding his lawnmower. But at the same time, the response is... Which side is this guy really on? He's really on the belief side. He just happens to have a weakness regarding Chilul Shabbos. But now I would make the argument in response, and this I think is a very important question, Bismanenu. We've seen the rise of social orthodoxy, right? Also known as orthopraxy. People who practice Judaism, because this is the community they're in, it's easier than breaking with the community, it's easier than breaking with their family, it's a good framework for my kids, whatever it is, but they don't believe. We've been assuming that this person who makes Kiddush and goes to work, his heart is with Kiddush. And the work is his title. But maybe in our day, you have to ask, it's actually the opposite. His heart isn't in it at all. He makes Kiddush because that's what we do in our community. But I'm not so sure you can read people's minds quite so well anymore. I think it's a very interesting question as to how this plays out, Bismanenu. The last point.
We also see certain areas... Like, for instance, like South Africa, people go to shul on Friday night and they make kiddush.
Right. The question would be, what do you do with...
And they go to work.
Right. What do you do with different communities which have different value systems? It's a good question. So those were three phenomena, right? We dealt with the change in education, leading to leniency in dealing with those people who we assumed didn't know any better. We talked about the growth of cynicism about religion, leading to strict approaches to those people who have rejected religion. We talked about the de-emphasis of practical observance, leading to leniency, and to say they're just breaking it with Tayabon, they don't consider observance that big a deal. The last bit is the shrinking of the observant community. And that leads to arguments in both directions. On the one hand, there's an argument called lamigder milsa, that we have to be strict in order to make offense. Meaning, if you let people do this, the community is going to fall apart. Everybody's going to get it. Once you see them get away with it, everybody's going to do it. The Nitziv, I brought you a number 23. He says, "Mena raglucha mamash." You got to stay away. Ki afkerusa mamshich alev. Their hefkerus draws the heart. And he says, you shouldn't start fights with them, but don't get close with them either. He's very strict about this. And even though we've seen Rav Moshe take a lenient view and say he's not really Machal Shabbos Befer Hesia, I brought you two tshuvos here where he took startlingly strong lines for the community. One in number 24 was about a Machal Shabbos duchening. He says, halachically, I think he can duchen. However, he says, maybe for Migdar Milsa, maybe to make offense, it will be better not to have them duchen. And in number 25, he's asked the question about a Jewish woman living with a non-Jewish man. They have a kid, and the kid's getting to be the age of bar mitzvah. And the question is, he asked Rav Moshe, do we let the kid have a bar mitzvah in shul? Give him an aliyah and everything, knowing he's Jewish, halachically, but he's being raised by a non-Jewish father. Now, do not try this at home. This needs to be dealt with in a very smart way in each community, in its own way. I'm not asking anything from it. But Rav Moshe says, number one, do not give him an aliyah as long as he's living in a household where there's a non-Jew living with a Jew. He says, you can't give him an aliyah. And he goes further than the question that was asked of him. This doesn't seem to be part of the question. And he says, don't admit him to your Talmud Torah. The next to last line, middle line. He says, you have to make offense. Don't admit the kid to school, he says. So there's an argument of stringency when the community is weaker. To prevent this from spreading, you have to draw a line. On the other hand, you see the flip side argument. Rav David Zvi Hoffman in the Malamed Lahoel in source number 26 says, you know what? There are so many people who are sinning nowadays. What this guy's doing doesn't stand out as so bad. He says, the end of the second line in number 26, after saying that this title of Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, he says the definition of Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia is that they're being very bold. They go out in public and they violate Shabbos and they don't care about the community. He says, Kevin Debab Anusenu Harabim Rubam Portsim Hageder. He says, since nowadays so many people are breaking down the fences, Takanasam Kalkalasam. So he's using Takanasam Kalkalasam in the backward way. He says, their kilkul helps them. The corruption of the community actually benefits them. Because this guy thinks it's not such a big deal. There's no reason for him to sin in private. The Malamed Lahoel is the one that we discussed before about counting them in a minion. So he says there are so many people who are sinning that it's not really like they're doing something bold and brazen by sinning in public. Everybody is doing this. And so it leads to an argument for leniency. There's such a shrinking community here that this guy isn't really being so bold and brazen. That's number one. And then the last argument for leniency is the community needs them. Rav Moshe Sternbach in source number 27 was asked this regarding a shul in Johannesburg, well, all the shuls in Johannesburg. He says, but I'm going to say to a rabbin, Barov bate knesios kan be Johannesburg, nosim imachon yo lebeis haknesis, belel Shabbos v'Shabbos, right, like Alan was saying. He says, in our shuls, people are driving to shul on Shabbos in all of our shuls. Ba'avar v'shana naslim keheter. He quotes the Gemara Moed Katan. You do a sin once, twice, it becomes like it's permitted for you. V'lo moel klal mashem efreslim lasar. And telling them it's usur doesn't help. It doesn't do anything. V'yesh kan batei knesios gedolim she'elem b'shabbos asara shomrei shabbos b'farhesi. He says you have major shuls which don't have 10 people who observe Shabbos publicly. And in bold, v'kasha lahoros shatzrichim lizkor batei knesios elu she'en asara shomrei shabbos b'farhesi. He says it would be really hard to tell people you have to shut down the shul. He says, sorry, you just can't do that. It's just not happening. You have another minyan you can go to? Good. But I'm not shutting down the shuls on this. Then he says in his next paragraph, I'm afraid to tell people it's okay to daven regularly like this, because then they'll just stop thinking of it as a problem altogether. So he says, what I'll do is I'll give a year-by-year heter. They have to come back to me every year and ask me, is this okay? And I'll let them go for another year. But they have to have it renewed every year so that they'll remember constantly, because it's true. Otherwise, people just assume, well, this is why we do it, this is why we've always done it. It must be okay. And then he concludes saying, but I'm not really sure what to do if you are called for a minion and they need you as the tenth. And without you, they won't have a minion. He's not so sure what to do in that regard. It also leads into a whole other discussion of Ava, of enmity. But the point is that the shrinking of the observant community leads on the one end to an argument of we better be strict in order to prevent sin. And it also leads in the opposite direction of, number one, we should be lenient because they're not that bad, these people you're talking about. But number two, the community needs them, and therefore we're better off keeping our institutions and including them and trying to make things better. God willing, Rabbi Ziering speaks next week, including the